Hello, everybody. This is Jeremy Swenson. I am the CEO of Abstract Forward Consulting. We are a cybersecurity process improvement and change management consultancy out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. We have a podcast where we cover a range of security and technology topics. Today, we have in the studio a really interesting individual, someone by the name of Chip Harris out of the Memphis, Tennessee area. And he has a boatload of experience with the government and the classified space, as well as experience all the way up to the CISO level. I'm going to let him introduce himself. The topic today is network scanning tips. So Chip, why don't you go ahead and just give our audience an introduction to who you are, what your path was, and then we'll go ahead and get into the topic of network scanning tips.
Sure, absolutely. My name is Chip Harris. I'm a senior cybersecurity infrastructure engineer as well as cybersecurity architect over the past 25 years. I'm also a certified ethical hacker, certified ethical pen tester, forensic investigator, and forensic auditor. I've specialized mostly in risk assessment, client-based audits, as well as application security, vulnerability management, pen testing, social engineering, as well as policies and procedures for government and healthcare.
Wow, what a great background to have! Let's just start at the very beginning. In your mind, Chip, if someone doesn't know anything about network scanning, maybe they know something about IT, maybe they know something about business, maybe they're an executive or a mid-level manager, they're making the decisions. In your mind, what's the description of network scanning for them?
Well, really, it's starting to look for the vulnerabilities. And I always tell people, they say, well, that's low-hanging fruit. Well, it's still fruit. Look at the total, what I call digital attack surface of your company, and when you're scanning that, start taking a look at the real, smaller things all the way down to the bigger issues. It's like, there's a pink elephant in the room and we've got to eat this elephant. So, we have to take it one bite at a time. So what do we need to start looking at? We need to start taking a look at policies and procedures, what's internal and external vulnerabilities, and then how would be able to test and remediate those fixes over a time period. So it really kind of starts off with, a very introspective look at yourself and your company and your organization, and then taking a look at, how can that be affected?
Right. We at Abstract Forward, we really focus on the small to mid-market and those clients, that are budget constraints. And network scanning, there's really two types of tools. There's the tools that cost some money, and then there's some of these open source tools, which actually some of them have a pretty good track record. I know both you and I have talked about OpenVAS before, which has a little bit of a learning curve and requires some configuration for it to be useful. But in your experience, what are the benefits of a tool like OpenVAS?
Well, the thing, though, too, is first off, it is free. It is open source. There's a little bit of configuration that has to go with it. But, you're taking a look at your compliance and your regulation, and you're taking a look at your risk and your vulnerability. Because, if you're especially within the small business space and so forth, budgetary concerns are always an issue. So when you're looking at your development and your enforcement of the IT practices and standards that you have to follow, say, for example, you have to follow NIST or PCI or HIPAA or SOX or so forth. These are government and, state and federal regulations that you have to follow. So it's always good to actually use some of that software that can generate those reports for you and be able to give you that information to say, like, wow, we are really vulnerable, on these endpoints, or, we need to do better firewall protection here, and our IoT device policies are not set up correctly. So it's very good to kind of use something like that to kind of get yourself a roadmap, from a scanning perspective, exactly where your vulnerability assessment and your actual network assessment needs to be looked at and needs to be addressed, and eventually will build into your security network protocols and procedures that you need to review either every year or every quarter.
Yes, comprehensive response there. One thing I want to talk about is patch management. Mm-hmm. A lot of organizations, I'd say all organizations, every single organization could do more and better patch management. Organizations struggle with patch management prioritization. Which of these patches is the most important right now? Because I don't have time and I don't have budget, mm-hmm. and I can't adjust the technology right now to do all of them. So what network scanning can do is it can help you get, like you said, that low-hanging fruit, something that, well, nobody really thought that that was unpatched, or nobody, maybe you forgot that you even had a tool that was running on this old operating system in some small part of your infrastructure, but due to network scanning, it has proven that it's still out there and it's still unpatched. That's the one thing you get out of network scanning is what is out there that still needs to be patched, and how can you escalate that as a prioritization to make sure you remediate that. And a good example of that is what happened at the Equifax breach. They had an Apache Stratus critical vulnerability exploiter, CVE, and they had not patched for that. Now, they had been given notice for 4 to 5 months prior. They had been given notice, and this was a level 10 severity CVE.
That's correct.
So there's an example where they're struggling with how do they prioritize? What is more important than something else that also needs to be prioritized? And so I'm going to ask a question to you. When you have those multiple patches I'm going to say the context here is a big middle company, upper middle size, not like Fortune 1000, not small, but upper middle size, where they have quite a bit of complexity in the infrastructure and they may have multiple patches.
Right.
In your experience, having been at a lot of companies, having done classified work for the government, what are some of the things that they can do to help decide among highly important patches which are the ones they should be patching first?
Well, you know, as I've always stressed this, especially with companies, is that your data is your commodity, you know, and your branding is also part of your business. And when that boils down into it, it boils down into a very simple thing that most people do not want to do, and that is creating a patch management schedule based around when Microsoft does their Patch Tuesday. And a perpetual updating, even if you're in a Linux environment, of a patch management schedule that needs to be remediated for high vulnerability systems. That's the first thing that you have to do, is take a look at those systems that are mission critical that you know need to be patched. And you have to schedule that across different groups between networking, development, you know, and other teams that are with inside your business unit to say, we need to be able to patch these systems. I know it's going to cause a little outage. I know that's going to cause heartburn, but you know, these are some of the things that you have to be able to do to guarantee the security of those systems. Because if those systems go down, or they're infected, or the information is stolen, then you're looking at a whole nother scenario of, you know, what's our DLP plan? You know, what, you know, we've been breached. How did this happen? You know, and to kind of give an example of that is, you know, and especially with Equifax, was they were told ahead of time that this was a huge severity. And they did struggle with how they're going to be able to implement that. They just didn't implement that within a certain amount of time frame. So I tell, you know, businesses that are medium to small to enterprise, whatever, so you need to have a really good patch management, you know, schedule set up to where you're able to patch those systems to be able to stop those actual data leaks or known vectors of attack to be able to do that. You know, for example, we still have Eternal Blue. We still have SQL Slammer. We still have all of these things that have been out there for years and years and years that some of the software companies have not developed patches for. But there are barriers that need to be put up to be able to stop those things from happening. And if you don't have those, it just gives you another exploit of weakness that would be able to affect a normal business process.
A couple things that I think you didn't touch on. Mm-hmm. One thing is the network mapping and then the dependency diagramming. So I've done a lot of this in my experience. When I think of patch management, I think everything you said would have inferred this, and that is, so if we're looking at 10 patches and, you know, the prioritization of all of them is anywhere from a 7, 8, 9, or maybe a 10, then the next question we need to ask is, okay, where does it fit in the network diagram map? Okay. In other words, what does it touch?
Right.
Because there are some pieces of tool or infrastructure, pieces that they may be in a very isolated, remote part of the network, right? And you got to know that if something truly is in an isolated remote part of the network, but it's rated really high in terms of risk and impact,
right,
you may be able to say that is not the top thing to mitigate. However, if something is in the center of your infrastructure with spider webs touching other key parts of servers and data, well, even if that's a lower rank impact, I would escalate that prioritization to do it now. To me, it's how close is the tool or piece of infrastructure to your critical data,
right? And where are those core systems touching, and what's their comprehensive baseline, what is the vulnerability that exists, and then what is the last time that we did this, patching or patch cycle, and what can we do to harden that system to make it more resilient?
With the case of Equifax, clearly they dropped the ball because this was it was a piece of technology. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was a server exploit, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
It was, in the center of their infrastructure. It wasn't far off in some remote warehouse server that is two layers removed from the main network. That isn't the case. They truly missed it. So let's talk now a little bit about leadership. Obviously, good leadership is a big part of, how we mitigate vulnerabilities and have a really good CISO strategy. In your view, having been at a number of companies, again, having been in the classified government space, what sort of is the thing that's lacking in leadership that connects to the practicality of the technical mitigation? And what do CISO leaders really need to be thinking about to make things better in security in the next 5 years?
Well, I would definitely say, that one of the key things that CISOs need to start taking a look at is doing more white boxing and black boxing of their internal and external networks, and do certified ethical hacking and pen testing, or what we call red teaming in the government, to actually test your systems. I've told people a million times over, you can have as many firewalls and barriers and, vulnerability scans and whatnot, but if it's not tested regularly, and it's not assessed regularly, it only takes one really good social engineering attack or phishing attack or vishing attack impersonation, and it will supersede all that, and once, the adversary, as the military puts it, or the hacker, or the state, state government, or, as they say, state nations like China, you see Myanmar, what I call the stands, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, when, they get into your systems and they get into your DNS and they get into all of your network and everything, and they lay dormant there for a while, they steal all your information, and then they start locking you out, there's nothing that you can do to stop them. So I always tell, other CISOs and other people, it's like, when was the last time you actually did a pen test, and tested all of your systems? When was the last time that you actually did, a trial run to say that there was a full breach of our systems, and what was our fallback, and how was our colo, and how was our DLP solution actually set up, and then how do we actually go back in there and forensically take a look at, how they picked apart this huge, gigantic, multi-layered system that we had created that's now been exposed.
That's at the later part of the kill chain. Mm-hmm. Want to step back a couple steps in the kill chain, and a couple of things you mentioned really alluded to this big security data lake concept, which I have some familiarity with this. And this is tied to network scanning too. So network scanning is going in, scanning the network, looking for low-hanging fruit vulnerabilities, things that need to be patched often come out of that, et cetera. You might find something else a little bit more complex related to an actual exploit, but likely not the case. But big security data lake, what that is it is basically like a giant data warehouse that is collecting all of your security event logs and even other types of logs that may be related to security event logs, And what it's trying to do is use some sort of machine learning or anomaly detection to, and this is particularly for the bigger mid-size organizations. Definitely the enterprise level do this as well, but definitely the mid-size, bigger ones do this. Some of the mid-size will do it, but probably not too many of the mid-size small doing it, just because they don't have that much data, unless they're really a data-intensive industry like healthcare payment processing or some sort of data or payment processing. I mean, there are some small businesses that are in the business of data processing and analytics and things like that, so they definitely would. But the problem that organizations have, and I've interviewed CISOs on this, is that they spend all this money building these big security data lakes, again, taking all these different logs, acting like a SIM, if you will, or having a SIM sit on top of it. There may even be multiple SIMs.
Correct.
I know organizations that have multiple SIMs for different parts of the organizational data, but the big security data lake is where all of it, you know, supposedly there for monitoring and learning to figure out, is there a hidden exploit or a hidden pattern that is the precursor of an attacker or a data breach clue that they could detect earlier in the big security data lake? The problem with these big security data lakes is they're not very accurate right now.
That's correct.
And there's a lot of false positives. And even with the SIMs, and just for those of you who don't know, SIM stands for Security Incident Event Management System. So it's essentially the same thing mostly as a data security lake, but the SIM is a tool on top of the security data lake that's made by some of the leading software companies like an HP, etc. makes one of those. But in your experience, Chip, what have you seen changing with the security data lake apparatus in the last couple of years, and what are some improvement opportunities that CISOs could take into consideration?
Well, one is definitely start taking a look at machine-based learning and the use of AI, artificial intelligence, to be able to take a look at the patternization of how users are moving data around, or therefore, you know, the ability to take a look at exactly what is the ingress data and then what is the outgress data of coming in and out of the system. And accessibility. It goes back to the original CIA principles, confidentiality, the integrity of the system, and accessibility to that data and to that system. So if you look at those base principles, which most security professionals actually try to follow and try to instill within our workforce, one of the things that I see that is really going to be changing in the next couple years is that how we're taking a look at how the machine is going to be looking at the false positives, is going to be looking at how the data is moving in and out of the network, how the actual information is being shifted from one place to another. The next thing, though, too, is that I see is that we are going to start seeing a lot more of this automation based process, kind of taking the human element out of it. So it's like, wow, we see there's a known vector because ABC virus has been changed from 1.0 to 2.0. We see that trying to attack our firewall and our system. You know, the machines and all of the stuff that we have that's integrated within our layered base system is starting to block that out. It's not, you know, we will start, you know, seeing that coming through our filterization of our email systems, through our IPsec, you know, and through the SIM-based data to start eliminating more of those false positives and actually start getting a more truistic, or what I consider to be a true map of what is actually being attacked within our systems and our networks.
Exactly. We've talked about a few things so far: network scanning, CISO leadership, data security lakes, and some related concepts. And let's talk now about the threat actor. You know, I think the threat actor, their profile, how they operate, the cyber kill chain, which is, you know, arguably how they get into a network. It's essentially the attack process. And for those of you who don't know, the cyber kill chain is a seven-step attack process that came out of Lockheed Martin's research after the F-22 hack.
Right.
The F-22 was a fighter jet that was being developed by the United States. It was the schematics of it were hacked by China. China then went and built a near replica of the F-22, thus stealing U.S. intellectual property. And so then Lockheed Martin said, look, we got egg on her face. We've got to go in and we've got to come up with the methodology. We got to say we learned something from this disaster. There's a saying in security that says never waste a disaster. And that means don't fail to learn from a disaster, because every disaster is going to teach you something. Now, with this threat actor profile, talk about in your experience, Chip, how does the threat actor operate? How do they change from month to month? What do CISOs and security leaders need to know?
Well, the threat actor, I would have to definitely say, and this just actually happened this week, and I saw an article to where China has actually got a chip that they have inserted at the hardware level, at the processor memory, you know, level, and at the motherboard level, a chip that's no bigger than the actual tip of a pencil that is stealing intellectual property, you know, from Apple, Amazon, Google, you know, at the hardware level. So there's a... This is something, you know, that we knew that was eventually going to come years back, that, you know, we were always talking about, exactly, you know, as you were talking about, the 7-step process, you know, of reconnaissance, weaponization, delivery, exploit, you know, installation, command and control, and the action objectives. Those basic 7 things that we actually have seen that, you know, threat actors will actually do. So we're now seeing not only the reconnaissance being done that, you know, state nations are doing within the actual, you know, world, but we're now seeing weaponization and forward adaptive based learning, not only at the software level, you know, we're now seeing it at the hardware level. For example, China has an entire community of hackers that actually live in basically a hotel, like almost a 12-story hotel. And that's all they do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is try to infiltrate, you know, systems for, you know, everything from corporate espionage to white collar crime to intellectual property theft, because they are very progressive about actually, you know, being able to be ahead of the curve of where we are in our delivery system. For our information, for our technology, for our weapons, you know, for our adaptive-based, you know, reconnaissance that we use against them. So the cyber war that originally started in 1994 is going long and strong, and probably will be going longer and stronger over the next couple years, considering that it's a push-pull of trying to actually breach into networks to try to actually find out exactly what these actors are doing with each other. And it's now started to go into the realm of HPC, high performance computing, to where they're building clusters of, you know, Hydra core, you know, teraflop processing, to be able to attack our defenses that we have here from our internet service providers down to the user level, on the government side, as well as the private industry side, to steal our intellectual property.
A couple of things come to mind based off the points Chip has made. And one of those things is that the threat actor is operating in a sort of crimeware as a service model at the same level of sophistication as the software as a service model sort of evolved and matured out of Silicon Valley, starting in the, arguably 80s, if you will.
That's correct. Yeah, I'd say that.
Right. But I mean, obviously it exploded in the 90s and then even more in the 2000s. But the point is that these threat actors truly are organized. And so you mentioned China. China is one such country that has these. Now, this is the government. So that's not the same thing as like the, you know, Ukraine-based or Russian-based cyber mob, if you will. But it is like the North Korean cyber army, because North Korea has an academy where they train young people in hacking, and they have them working nonstop in those, like you said, concentrated facilities. But that's what they do. And that's that. So the point that we're making here is that innovation is coming out of the threat actor, because the threat actor is getting organized and they are trying to innovate, just like software as a service started to innovate into the 80s, 90s, and then that really exponentially leaped in the 2000s, especially with Oracle and Salesforce and other cloud companies. But the threat actors a lot of times are more creative than the traditional establishment
right.
tech providers. And that's the irony of the situation. And so my company, Abstract Forward Consulting, you know, everything we do is we're putting abstract forward thinking first because it's lacking in the technology space. But the thing is, if a threat actor is showing a better use of creativity and innovation, in your mind, Chip, what can the private sector company learn from the creativity that the threat actor uses?
Well, I would definitely have to say, and this is one of the things that I always implore is always think outside the box. It's like, you know, what is this person or this threat actor going to do different than everybody else? Because the abstract forward thinking like that you're talking about is the ability to think outside of the box, you know, and you hear that term a lot, but the thing that sets those kinds of people apart is that they're looking at code. They're looking at different things that are changing in network topology. You know, they're looking at things that are changing in hardware. They're looking at things that are, you know, different operating systems that they're going to be able to use. So they're looking at a mixture of things to be able to build something that's going to be able to launch that attack. To kind of give you a very good example of that from a state nation, the two that scare me the most are the Iranians, because the Iranians are recruiting very, very young, talented people almost at the high school level and then bringing them into the fold of the military for their training and give them jobs and guaranteed, you know, income for life. The second one is the Israeli government. If you look at Unit 8200, it's almost a competition to get into that service in the Israeli government, because they know after they serve in that, you know, capacity of being a cyber war fighter, that after they leave that part of the military, that they can go to any company and make millions of dollars because they've learned the abstract forward thinking of looking at things that affect, you know, different vulnerabilities from a technical and human standpoint. And they probably are the ones that are at a very younger generation than myself that are looking at exploits to probably create some of the best network breaches, malware, and security and exploits for security vulnerabilities that I've ever seen.
So we at Abstract Forward, as a key part of our strategy, is questioning traditional assumptions and really trying to shake the framework-only security assessment or the accounting firm-based security assessment. It's just, quite frankly, not good enough, and it's kind of stuck in the past. Now, if we look at what's happened in the last, say, 20 years in the messaging technology. So when I say messaging, I mean like texting. Well, before texting, it was paging. But so let's just start with the paging. Then let's move on to what's the next thing. So maybe it's the cell phone, then it's cell phone with text. And then what you have there after that is then you have the social media. And then you have the messaging via social media. And then you have the geolocation added to it, meaning it's able to tag where you are based on geolocation. So you can see, you know, my friends in this block area are on the Facebook Messenger app, right? And then you have the next level, which would be like a WhatsApp. And so WhatsApp adds a layer of encryption. So WhatsApp, I would say, is the best of all of those and the most secure WhatsApp. But WhatsApp is harder to maintain. So anytime you have a better level of security,
right,
it's more work to maintain. And obviously, it's a little bit less convenient, too, for the user. But so that's just an example of, you know, where messaging has been in you know, the last 20 years, high-level, rough estimate. But what are your thoughts on where you think messaging needs to change or go in the next 5 years to get better? Obviously, messaging is used to trick people, you know, to do phishing, to do smishing. Messaging is used, and there's all kinds of messages that are the result of an exploit. I mean, messaging. What are your thoughts on the security of messaging?
Well, I look at it as another vector of attack because it is an IoT device, you know, and what makes it so dangerous is that, you know, where we have started, you know, back in the pager days down to what we're doing now with real-time text messaging, you know, and it says, oh, we'll click on this link, you know, and so forth. Well, now I've been able to infiltrate not only your device and not only the messaging part of the system. If that's connected to, let's say, the cloud, that's connected back to a company, that's connected back to a service, I mean, it starts, the snowball starts rolling down the hill and starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger exponentially.
Messaging, bear that in mind, but add in that all of the authorizations and communications from mobile apps. So there's all these apps, whether it's the Google Play Store apps or whether it's the iTunes apps, but all these apps, and this is, we're talking mobile device, you know, tablet, pad, cell phone, smartphone, really. But the point is that the messaging is one thing, but then tie that in with all the access and data feed that these all these different apps are getting. So if a message is coming through and there's, I mean, there's a lot, the point I'm making is there's a lot of ways for a threat actor to exploit via messaging and the intersection of all the apps that you're running, because those apps have to have access to a lot of things.
Right.
Your camera, your geolocation, and then in some cases they do have access to your messaging data. So there's a lot of vulnerabilities and exploits that come out of apps, and the apps are able to sometimes get into your messaging and then send out more fake messages to get people to click on frivolous links. But so now I'm going to ask you, what are your thoughts on the app security and the complication around all the things that the app needs to have access to? And then, you know, there's two schools of thought here. There's some people say, don't use many apps, don't trust a lot of apps, only trust a really few amount of apps. Not even the ones in the Play Store are all good, they're saying. And that's true, because there have been numerous ones in the Play Store and in the iTunes Store that have made it through and that they said were fine, and that was all a lie.
Right. And the thing is I come from that school of thought, because I don't have many apps on my phone, because I use my phone as a phone. I don't use it as a digital lifestyle device. I don't use it as a messaging system. I don't use it as a social media, you know, outlet. I use my phone as a phone. I have computers and servers and everything else that I use for that, you know. And the other thing though too is that if it's a work phone or something, you know, I try to not ever put apps only unless I'm told by the company to be able to do that because of the internet use policy. Because if that's tethered or rooted or backed up, you know, to a company server or so forth, if that app has app, you know, the ability to penetrate the phone, then it's got ability to bypass by proxy into the actual system itself. But, you know, and that's one of those things I always try to preach to companies is, you know, take a look at that IoT device and what actual applications that you have on it, because if it's rooted or tethered or, like you just said, backed up to other systems, it might be just bleeding information, your information, if not company information, you know, to the adversary.
Yeah, exactly. And this, so if I think of VIPs, and a VIP would be somebody like a CEO or a elected official in there doing official business, you know, or a general in the military context, typically those individuals are going to have a couple of phones, and they have a secure phone, which, you know, all it does is it's just, you know, a special digital secure phone, and it has no other apps running on it. And then they have the apps on something else. But from a corporate standpoint, the thing that a lot of corporations are struggling with is this work from home or work remotely growth. And, you know, there's private data that a remote worker may have on their device, company issued device we're talking about here. But then this concept of containerization comes in, and containerization can really help mitigate the risk of this complexity at the intersection of messaging and app authorizations on a mobile device. So basically, containerization, what it does is it basically separates out your business data for the organization which you work, and your personal data, and that business data and the business apps, which there's some, is separated and encrypted and doesn't talk to or touch. This is arguably doesn't talk to or touch. I mean, obviously there's ways to hack that, but theoretically, it works pretty well, and it seems to be a growing area, this containerization. So one way to defend, if you're going to be using mobile devices, and let's face it, who doesn't use them, but some companies and industries are more mobily focused than others, is to containerize, is to separate out, and then to your point, limit apps. I mean, I find it amazing that people get excited about a new app here or a new app there because there's buzz about it, or there's talking about it, and they don't do anything to check out well.
Right. And I tell people, it's just human nature. I tell people, just because it's convenient necessarily doesn't mean that it's secure. You know, it comes into, you know, best practices and common use practices. I mean, you know, and I totally agree with you, you know, and is your device encrypted or not? Do you, what kind of security scanning software do you have on your device? You know, and there's plenty of companies I've talked to that's like, well, we don't have any kind of, you know, security, you know, on our cell phones or IoT devices or our tablets or whatnot. I'm like, well, you have it on your computers, right? Yes. You have it on your laptops? Yes. So why don't you have it on your other devices? I mean, it just kind of blows my mind that, you know, it's like, this is just a, you know, another device that you have to be able to lock down and secure just like anything else within, you know, your organization. And it just, you know, it's to me very reckless and irresponsible that you're not doing that. And I agree, just because it's a new app and it looks nice and shiny and cool and everybody thinks it's awesome and whatnot, necessarily it might not be the best thing to put on your phone.
Right. I think we're going to see more apps are going to be found to be malicious. And I think even some state-sponsored threat actors probably have apps out there that are, you know, monitoring and doing some sort of intelligence gathering. But this has been a great call for everybody. Again, we have Chip Harris on the call here. He is a former three-letter agency cleared CISO consultants and technical architect security consultants. And we are talking about network scanning and related best practices around disruptive information security. At the end of this call, money is always a factor. You know, I talk to a lot of CISOs, yes. I talk to a lot of CIOs, and, you know, I like to bring up the open source because they can save some money. But in your experience, as we end out this this great interview, what are the best ways for a CISO to get the most bang for their buck?
Yeah, as I tell people, you know, especially, you know, at that level, you know, when you're looking at your talent pool, for example, and this goes back to the what I consider to be human element of things that you need to have in your security arsenal of people. You need to have someone that is very well versed in open source technology, as well as the technology that you have in there, and constantly keep learning about, like, programs, for example, Metasploit, Wireshark, Nexpose, Vega. If they're a if they do or a mid-sized business and they have the ability of buying or purchasing Tenable, you also have, like, for example, Nagios, and learn the different operating systems that pen testers use that are mostly free, that cost you nothing. It just basically, you can take an older laptop, as long as it has the bare minimum specs, to start putting, for example, like Kali Linux on there. Parrot OS, Kane OS, Black Box OS, Black Arch Linux, you know, and start learning those programs and start testing your system. Start doing everything that we've talked about today. This is to start taking a look at your internal map, start doing, you know, white boxing, black boxing test with those vulnerability scans that you've looked at. Try to do your own internal pen test. Take a look at what's happening inside the DMZ and outside your DMZ. Take a look, you know, and try to do a test run of your own social networking on your own network, you know, because, you know, companies spend lots of money on training and certifications and teaching their staff to be able to do, you know, and look for these things. Try it on them. Do it, you know, you know, take a look and see, you know, how our remote access policies work. You know, try to fish your own people, you know, try to see how those things work, and then kind of go from there.
All right. I feel like I'm talking to a basketball coach because he said, just do it. Get that ball in the basket. Be successful. And the one thing that kind of comes out of what you said is you mentioned certifications, you mentioned training, and those are good. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I think organizations can do to really get the most bang for their buck is make sure that they're employing a strategy that doesn't over rely on security certifications or traditional training, meaning that don't think just how you've thunk before. That can be a big problem. Now, another way to get a lot out of security spend is figure out where you can save money. And what I've found in my experience, and we at Abstract Forward, we're very good at this, is we evaluate the effectiveness of existing security applications. So if we take email scanning and we say, you know, we have three tools, all of which cover some part of email scanning. Okay, well, what are you paying for those three? And then we map out and say, well, what is this one actually validated to mitigate, right? What's the percentage? So of the three, which does mm-hmm. the most? And if you took one away, would the cost of taking away that one tool be worth doing because the other two covered, or is there some free open source tool that you can put in there? Shutting down software can actually save you a lot of money. So those are ways to be more effective and to save money. And of course, you're going to have to spend some money. The open source tools and some of the tips around how to use good people and train them to be effective, those are all on point for sure. But again, thanks everybody for listening today. That's all we have. So with that, I'm gonna ask Chip for any last comments outgoing to our audience.
Definitely take a look at your cybersecurity awareness. Everything from identity threats, identity vulnerabilities, your access risk exposure. Establish some kind of contingency plan and respond always to your cybersecurity incidents.
Thank you very much. This is Jeremy Swenson. We're Abstract Forward. You're listening to Chip Harris, CISO consultant. We will catch you next time.